Hello, and welcome to Muse and Metrics. This is your host, Philippa Burgess. This is Season 5, Episode 5, and today's topic is heightened awareness.
My name is Vaishnavi. I'm from beautiful British Columbia, Vancouver, Canada. I'm also a Women Techmaker Ambassador from Vancouver. I am a software engineer by profession. I work at EA, that's Electronic Arts Studio, based out of Burnaby, BC. And I'm very passionate about working collaboratively, champion of DEI, neurodiversity, and accessibility. The growth I have seen just being a part of WTM has been exponential. I think what perhaps takes years and years, sometimes close to a decade, I could kind of condense it within this short 11-month duration. I participated in so many International Women's Day panels within the WTM by virtue of having so many people always looking for speakers or panelists or collaborators. I managed to collaborate in 3-4 places and also co-organize and talk about things I'm passionate about, technology, in the realms of AI, and also the other passion of mine is visual communication. How do you integrate visual communication and storytelling in the art of explaining technology so that everyone feels belonged and not get overwhelmed by tech is some geeky, a god side of things and with that only few people can access. Absolutely no. It's just the art of storytelling. So that's how WTM helped me get exposure, and I was able to use the medium to present in so many places, and then one thing led to another, and then, you know, with the power of social media, people said, hey, I like this talk. Can you also collaborate here and there? And just things started coming to me very organically. There's a saying that your vibe attracts your tribe. So sometimes, you know, when you don't have a particular platform, you just keep broadcasting, trying to see if there's a like-minded person. But then having a medium like WTM, they have done the homework. They have picked the best of best, people who are advocates, allies, people who are passionate about tech, who are women. So, you know, it kind of fit all the criteria, and all you need to do is just bring those voices from that platform. All you need to do is just send a message in some channels, and then you'd be amazed.
I have been so blessed that I've done 2 summits, and now I'm doing the season, and every time I've done a call out, my calendar just fills up. It's like, yay, thank you so much.
When you have to kind of pick people versus you reaching out in 1,000 places and then just setting the ball rolling, here you just broadcast and then things come to you organically.
It's been joyful, and I'm very happy about that part of it. So let's go back into your work. You're in Vancouver, BC, and what inspired tech? I know some of the conversations I've had between the American culture, I'm not as familiar with the Canadian culture relative to the South Asian culture, because I find in like our American culture, if you're interested in math and science, you're the outcast. You're not, it is not as welcome. And I look at our media and I look at how we in shows and media kind of reflects society as well. Talk about storytelling. And we send messages to our kids that if you want to be popular, math's not the way to go. And I feel the South Asian culture definitely celebrates math and sciences way, way more than we do in the North American culture. And I feel that it is something that I want to talk about and make sure that people can understand that there's really cool things in the math and science conversation. And I also felt excluded from math and science until I stepped into a technology certificate and now a master's of science, and that I can own and claim my identity as a woman in STEM and a woman in tech. So tell me a little bit about your journey.
I don't want to generalize, but speaking from a South Asian, I'm Indian by origin, by roots. All my ancestors, everyone's from India, so I speak solely from that perspective. But STEM and STEAM as such is highly worshipped in cultures where I come from. It's like the total opposite of what you mentioned. Here, you can have your hobbies, you can be a stand-up comedian, you can be an artist by night, you can moonlight that, but you need to have a STEM degree or at least a degree primarily focused on science and technology or math because that's where your day job comes from. That's where you feel like your money can come from. Everything else is a hobby. Whatever you do, anything else, you could be a graffiti artist, you can be a painter, you can just run some events, but they all are secondary jobs. So it's very, very unpopular culture coming from the Canadian, from the North American culture. And I moved to Canada just about close to 5 years back. So it's a very recent phenomenon. But then coming from a place where it's like every second person a stone's throw away is an engineer by choice or by force, to here where it's just that not so many, and it's now like, oh, there's so much of celebration, there's so much of awareness and inclusion towards that. And it just felt a little confusing to me, because I almost thought, because North America, more so the Silicon Valley in the States, is the hub for tech. So I assume that pretty much every person or 90% of it is primarily tech-based, or people default have STEM degrees. So that was a little different. But then in our culture, at least in our community in India, it's a de facto. It's like you do engineering and then figure out what you want to do with your life. It's generally like that.
And that's very different. And I think the AI machine learning kind of wave that's on us right now is inspiring a lot more people to say, oh, maybe I should learn a little bit more about the foundations of what go into this, because it is something I can even see the US government is putting out programs for You Belong in STEM and trying to make STEM more attractive to kids and more inclusive to kids and more welcoming, because the future requires these jobs and these skills. And yet,
digital, right?
Well, I feel like the last 20 years, didn't matter who we were, we've all had to become digitally literate. And now we're in data literacy. And data is the new place that we're at. And it doesn't matter who you are, everybody's lives is impacted by AI and machine learning and technology. And so those are things that are becoming just more obvious. But then also, as we transition in the workplace and the role of women and the role of diversity, and you touched on neurodiversity and being an advocate and a champion for neurodiversity. Can you talk about how you're seeing that being embraced in the workplace and kind of the types of advocacy that you do and how you self-identify as neurodivergent?
I think the last decade or so, everything has, there's so much greater awareness towards neurodiversity, accessibility in product, UI, UX, design, having people come into focus groups, even in gaming communities, because earlier we never felt represented or never felt heard. And, you know, there was no concept of shift left learning where, you know, these things come as a part of your requirements, part of your design. It was more of an afterthought earlier. But then if you know about this saying, right, nothing about us without us, it's primarily right. If you want to make certain products or all products better for the community, you need to involve them or involve us. Growing up, I've always been a late bloomer. It kind of takes time. I've been a slow learner, and also the ADHD aspect. And it's just, I had some triggers when I get stressed, I stutter, or sometimes sensitivity to sound and light and so many things. So it's every time I look at any user experience, I'm always thinking, did they check for color blindness? I have color sensitivity. And sometimes I get overwhelmed with certain softwares because of the sheer number of pop-ups, sheer number of things that startle me out of the blue, an audio message, a flash message, right? So I've been noticing it earlier, but then thankfully in the last decade, with so much emphasis coming primarily from the gaming community and Discord and other places, I feel like I can actually use my voice to make products better. And by better, it doesn't mean it has to be complicated with 10 layers. By better, it's just being too simple, where you just don't confuse anybody. You just do bare minimum. If you are logging in or signing up on a new website, you just sign up. You don't do extra things. Just, you know, the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. It's all that. And I finally felt belonged, and with lot of voices in LinkedIn and many places, and even games like Sims talking so much about it, it just felt like, oh, now it's kind of good trend. Sometimes, you know, these things, if they're in trend, it's also good for us, because that way the advocacy and awareness factors also go up.
It's very helpful to think about user experience and that different people come at things with different needs as far as, and you talk about like the light sensitivity, the sound sensitivity. I do notice that now there's more things that will have a warning in advance of them if there is going to be something that is a trigger warning. I think that that didn't really exist before. I think there's more of awareness. And I think that the voices absolutely need to be heard, because if we're not speaking up, then it's not becoming part of the culture. And then those changes aren't being made and those products being developed and modified. So I think that's very incredibly important work. I come at it just in terms of more of sort of an ADHD diagnosis, and have always been very independently minded and have this way of being in the world that I don't notice is different, but I notice a lot of people reflect back to me that, oh, you just think differently and operate differently. And I did notice that my tendency to interrupt people was not meant to be socially inappropriate. It was meant to express my enthusiasm, or that my thinking had already finished the end of their sentence, so I was already ready to respond. And I think that at least being diagnosed helped me become more aware of those things. But I've always needed bosses and managers who embrace who I am and take my talents that might not even exist if I wasn't neurodiverse, and embrace them and work with me on things, because I can oftentimes make things far more complicated than they need to be. And I love them saying, okay, this one's simple, or this one's super time sensitive, you know, just make sure you, and knowing, helping me to prioritize. Yeah, there's certain things I think it's important to also be working with people who understand you from a boss, manager, leader, management.
I have had good experiences and bad experiences. I think it's also cultures. I've been moving countries and then working with companies which are based out of Europe, sometimes based out of India, sometimes based out of North America. So it's not just the company culture, it's also the team culture, it's your manager's culture. It's about what culture trickles from the headquarters, what kind of awareness they have. So I've had good, bad, ugly experiences of all this range. And you said about things where, you know, losing a train of thought or interrupting. I have those, and I work a lot to ensure that my triggers don't come out. I have 100% of all those. When I'm very mindful, I can work on all these triggers, but any stress trigger, any sensitivity, that's it. It blows up, and then, you know, I just let the guard down, and then things go berserk, right? I totally get that. And sometimes I've been told so many times, oh, you don't get it, you don't understand. It's because I'm slow. I take time, you know. So I definitely hear all of them, and I've had lots of issues with emotional regulation, and I always thought I'm sensitive, but then I didn't realize that being neurodiverse, your emotional regulations are very different. I'm very, what you see is what you get, you know, literally like how you see in HTML. I'm very, I don't know where to mask, where not to mask. If you say, how are you? I would actually say how I am, than just say I'm good, you know, how superficial people just say that. But then there are so many things, and somewhere being neurodiverse also meant I was extra vulnerable. Such people get bullied a lot more, get targeted a lot more, get isolated. They're the first to be knocked off because they're different. They are very difficult to accommodate in many other terms. Or they say, oh, it's difficult to work with them. Earlier, I would buy into those things and say, oh, it's me. It's me. I am the problem, right? But it took me years and perhaps decades to understand that I'm actually different, because I always thought everyone's like this. I'm just challenging, I'm struggling within me. And I think everyone does. Then why do you speak about it, right? Because, you know, you just can't keep complaining and whine about everything. But then I realized, no, people who are in the neurodiverse spectrum are more prone to anxiety, get easily diagnosed with depression and anxiety, where it's not that, it's just emotional regulation aspect. And then the brain working differently. So I had managers who were absolutely not aware of any of these things, you know, who, and back in the day, even a performance evaluation, many things, they had standard boxes to raise the bar, right? You just fit in a bell curve, so to say, and then see which end of the spectrum is. But now, thanks to a lot of awareness in the last decade or so, you feel represented even in terms of applying for jobs. You know, you see so many places where they said, do you need any accommodation? Do you actually feel neurodivergent? Do you actually identify? Some people say it's better to reveal. Some people say no. Again, it's a debate to have it. But the very fact that someone's willing to give you that voice to say, you know, are you neurodivergent? Is there any accommodation to help you with? I think that's a good start.
That's a very good start. And I think there's so much that goes back to, as you were saying, the corporate culture, the management culture, you know, who is on that team and how that team interacts really defines many people's experience at a company, is who your managers are and who's on your team and how they either understand or don't understand can really, like you said, make that good, bad or ugly.
Exactly. So that's one of the reasons why people quit as well, right? They quit for the manager, not necessarily for salary or anything. So there you go. Mm-hmm. And some of the organizations that I work back home, I think earlier when you grow in the technical ladder from engineer, senior engineer, principal engineer, after that, you de facto become a manager. There wasn't a role which is completely technical where you're just focusing on the architecture side of things. But then not necessarily everyone is not a manager. Some people just like to be, but then they didn't have a growth because every 2-3 years you're bound to get promoted, and then they didn't have a box where they can still be an independent contributor or just stick to tech. They got the challenges of people management. Some people don't like it, you know, because don't get me wrong, most of the time people management is also ego management. You're playing with egos of seniors and juniors. Some people who are very good at what they do, but their attitude is very different, like they are the best. So you're playing with people's attitude and ego as well. So, you know, they didn't have a special category where they can just grow by themselves. So I think that's where also the problems stem from. And they didn't want to become manager, but if you want to be promoted, you have to take that step.
It reminds me of the Peter Principle. Are you familiar with that one?
No.
So the Peter Principle basically
says
that everybody gets promoted to their place of inefficiency, like or incompetence. You get promoted. So you can't push your way up to promotion. It's more that there's a vacuum to fill, and that corporations live on a bell curve. And so if you're too good, you're out. If you're too bad, you're out. But everybody's sort of in that average middle. And then you get promoted because there's a vacuum to fill, and they look for who's the most best qualified of the team that we can kind of pull up to this next position. And then when it comes time for the next promotion, you've been promoted to a point of incompetence. So you're not the next qualified person to be promoted again. And so people just get stuck at their level of incompetence.
Exactly. And Peter Principle also talks about where you indirectly are preparing for the next role before, without you knowing that you are there. It's a curse and a boon sometimes. Sometimes you don't want it, but if that's the way to be benchmarked, then you just take it, right?
Yes, but I do think that that idea that companies can actually be thinking about training their managers and having manager support, manager mentorship, making better managers, because if they're the linchpin of what makes an employee experience better and adds to retention, I think, you know, really understanding what makes a good manager, I think there's a lot more managers who can use that support. And I think a lot of companies also don't acknowledge that, and that some managers don't know to ask for help, or that there's a whole way of understanding that becoming a manager is its own growth and its own learning.
Exactly. And also, I mean, talking about management, it's also about conditioning. Sometimes we all have generational trauma. We all have our own stereotypes. We all have our own conditional bias. We all have so many judgments, and till you talk to someone, you wouldn't realize that, you know, sometimes it's very easy for me to advise, and then weeks, months, years down the lane, I'm indirectly doing the same thing because I got conditioned, and it takes so much more time to unlearn. For example, when I was in India, I was primarily dealing only with Indians, right? Give or take a few foreigners. And then here I am in Canada, and I have a colleague who's from Europe, another colleague from Australia, you know, across the pond and so many places. And then I'm like, no, I have these judgments. I'm like, oh, Russians are good at this. You know, there's so much of judgment. And I've realized I've been advocating for things. And I'm also, you know, sometimes you need to talk the talk and walk the walk. But I wasn't doing that because of this, again, biases that I had built in. And then every day I try to unlearn. Sometimes it doesn't come naturally, so I have to be mindful. Earlier, I could just speak my mind because I think that's how I am. I can speak my mind, and we are in a democratic country. You can just speak. To where I am right now, I really think twice, because your intentions are very different from your actions and your body language, right? If I'm talking to someone who's represented in the LGBTQIA, how is my tone coming across to them? Am I putting them down indirectly? Am I being nice to them? Am I taunting them? Maybe I have respect to them, but maybe I don't understand it, right? So now there are so many more layers that I have to be super aware of these nuances. How do I address their name? What's their pronoun? Am I literally using gender stereotypes? You know, just because you look a certain way, am I addressing you with the gender, but you belong somewhere else? So there's so many more layers that every day I feel like, just because I'm very free-spirited, I can talk my mind, no. But when you're talking to so many people, especially in the leadership, it's like not every finger is the same, right? Each one is of different type. I have also have to learn all these and then ensure that at the end of the day, I need to make sure everyone feels safe, everyone feels heard. So it all comes back to basic human needs, human rights, you know, all the fluff, extra layer of promotion, money, those are all very next level. Are you making that person feel human? You know, that's kind of the bottom line we need to talk about.
Very much. And I think that in these conversations where we're talking about technology and we're talking about coding, we're talking about software development, and there's a huge people element to this, both in the teams that are required to create this and the working environments, and then the end user experience and how that is able to be accessible and deliver a successful experience for having the end user and the customer in mind. So people are a huge part of technology. Having good communication skills, having good people skills, good management skills, being a good leader, and then knowing as well where to look for our heroes and our mentors and finding and building our communities and our friendships and our peers. And so people are absolutely key. And I think that Google has done a good thing to bring this community of women together to support each other, to celebrate each other, to build this network, to build these friendships. I think that is so important because it goes so much more than technology. It goes to people. In a small way, I was proud of myself for attending a GDG event in New York City for International Women's Day. And there was there was breaks between the panels, and there's an open networking. And I saw these two young ladies standing next to each other, looking doe-eyed. They didn't know each other. They weren't engaged with each other. They were just in the corner looking rather stunned and isolated. And I could just tell that they had no idea how to approach networking, how to approach this group of people who were chatting among each other. And I kind of scanned the room, and I just went directly to them, introduced myself, allowed them to introduce themselves to me, introduce themselves to each other. And as soon as we started talking, other people came and joined us. And then when I naturally kind of moved on to other parts of the room, they now had a little conversation going. They now were welcome. They were now included. They were now happy. And I just felt so much joy for such a simple interaction to help them not just be so doe-eyed in the corner by themselves.
Exactly. And one of the things that we fail to see as managers, as software engineers, is how can we make leadership more introvert friendly? You know, be it networking, public speaking, it's all about trying to be trying to market yourself, you don't have to be loud. Sometimes, you know, you can still be silent and have your voice being heard. And unfortunately, I have noticed time and again, a lot of events in the name of networking wants us to kind of come out of your comfort zone and just keep talking, be the cheerful step. But intrinsically, some people aren't like that. They are very shy, they're introvert. And I was one such person. It took me 5 years to kind of work on myself, to kind of put myself out there. And again, it's not my natural self. It takes a lot for me. I don't like any attention when people, I said, just don't post my name, just don't tag me. I don't know, it still doesn't come naturally. Again, I'm working on that. But then as workplace, as company, don't judge people just because they're introverts. Some people are not good at icebreakers. Some people are not good at small talk. They just cut to the point because they feel like their energy can be better invested in just designing things, doing better things. That's where the inclusivity aspect comes in. And definitely, sometimes I've been to conversations where I zone out. I go to my own world for various reasons. It's, again, my neurodiversity kicking in. Or sometimes there was a meetup, I remember, amazing meetup. I paid a premium. All that was great. And after every icebreaker, they had a big gong. And they would hit the gong. And I think, so it's a way of indicating you switch the rounds, switch the tables and stuff. That gong gave me so much of startled me so much and kind of got my anxiety levels up because of the sound, you know, because I had that extra sensitivity. It took me 20 minutes for my heart rate to normalize. Everyone else had no effect except for me because I startled. And then I had to literally go to the person who was comparing and said, hey, next time before you hit the gong, just make eye contact with me and just kind of give a heads up so that I'm prepared. Okay, it's very trivial. The earlier me wouldn't even have the courage to go tell them that because it's not their fault, right? They wouldn't know what it means to be on the side. But then only last year when this happened, I went to the comparer and said, hey, you know, and after that, for the next five rounds, whenever they had to switch tables and switch people, she would make eye contact and say, hey, I'm going to, and then I was prepared. I didn't startle. But and once I startle, it's like a tumbleweed, you know, I can't focus, I can't talk. I'm just there, but I cannot participate. You know, there's so many challenges. That's when I realized if I have this issue, an introvert can have their own issues, but their problems are not seen or not heard because they can't speak it out.
It's definitely important because I also feel like introverts oftentimes do harder work. They do quieter work. And oftentimes the extrovert is out there loud and proud about things that they know nothing about. And sometimes this is even gender related. I had an incident recently where I was speaking to a gentleman and he is an expert in AI. Why? Because he's read some headlines about it. And and I'm sitting here, I'm completing a certificate program. I'm going for my second master's. I'm doing as much as I can to just learn and actually be proficient, into which I'm speaking about, oh, there's a lot to learn. And I'm very approaching it from I'm at the bottom of the mountain, just kind of climbing in my own, you know, small steps, and realize how big the mountain is. And he is just at the top of the mountain. And even though he was kind of airlifted in and dropped off there, and it sometimes it's a gender thing too. And it really reminded me that just because someone can have the showmanship about it doesn't actually mean that they have the skills.
I totally get that. I mean, there's gender, just generation. We have so-called zenilians. If you know the term zenilian, it's just analog childhood, digital adulthood. For me, digital adulthood happened way, way like in my 20s or so. So it's just this thing, and I get you so many times. I feel like I know a lot, but even to ask the question, I'm like, I have to do my research. Maybe this answer is Googleable. I have to strive. It reminds me of someone telling me that nowadays the movie reviewers, some of the reviewers on Twitter, they don't even watch the movie. They just hear. So some people live tweeting from a movie theater, just these scenes, and they're reviewing based on it. Your story reminded me of how some people have not even watched the movie, and they're just reviewing based on inputs from various sources and some threads and Twitter here and there. It feels like someone's, like, you see some scholars, they spent years and decades, and then some person who's very extroverted just picks up some fancy video or audio, just pass it off their own, or they just get more attention, where the originator just silently did all this research for decades, right?
And to be aware of that in ours, that's a different kind of bias, but that is something that I think that the Tech Maker Ambassador Program is helping women Tech Maker Ambassadors, who I feel when I talk to the many of you I've been talking to, that we all come with strategic leadership and operational leadership. We know how to think about things. We know how to get things done. Where I'm seeing the growth, it's a growth in myself, probably growth in you, is that we're becoming better thought leaders and better bridge building leaders, and learning how to speak up about our accomplishments and what we do know, and clear about what we don't know and what we're moving towards learning. I know that that same New York event that I went to, I met my first GDE, the first person who introduced themselves to GDE, and immediately thinking, tell me more. I'm interested in this. That sounds really interesting. And then have begun this process of saying, I want to become a GDE. And as I heard you say on our group call the other day, you're in that process as well. And how much humbleness I think we tend to be as we approach what we consider to be a very high level credential, and how well prepared we want to be for that, and finding our path forward. Trust me, this gentleman that I was speaking to, he would have already applied and possibly even gotten it, because that the absolute just sense of entitlement and confidence in all ways, that the way that we approach things is much slower, much more diligent, much more detail oriented,
methodical. Yeah. And that reminds me of, yeah, to be honest, till last year I didn't know WTM, forget GDE, forget GDG, forget GDS. I didn't even know any of these things, you know. And to start with this, I'm slowly catching up. And then thanks to the Google I/O and Google, the events that we attended in Florida and in San Francisco. And then just I met someone called Madhusha. He's, I believe, the program manager for GDG, if I'm not wrong. And then I didn't know how to ask, how do I become a GDG? And then, you know, he gave, and everyone is busy. And then I said, look, I've done so many presentations. Like, he said, do you have it all consolidated in a place? He said, maybe my GitHub. He said, do you have a sessionized profile? I said, yes. Can you put all your talks there? So till yesterday, all I did was I only put all my technical talks there, and then again nudged him. Can you guide me on the next steps? He said, do you know about WDA, Developer Academy? I said, I just about recently applied and I actually got through. He said, that would be a good starting point. And he said, I've also heard you doing other things. Where are there? I said, those are non-tech. You know, I did do a lot of talks about visual communication, and then as introvert, some strategies, a lot about how do you visually talk about yourself without talking, right? By just visualizing your things, your thought process. So I've done a lot of presentations. I said, I didn't put it because GDE is supposed to be only like a hardcore tech things. He said, no, you should learn to market yourself. And I had to facepalm myself because I didn't put any of that. And why am I being so shy? It's not like I took credit from some, it's all my baby, something I did, but I didn't put any of that. He said, no, you should learn to put that in market. And in a way, he's helping me. And but again, it's not coming naturally to me because I've done all this work. People don't see it, but to give a 15 to 20 minute talk, it takes 20 hours of research. The shorter the duration I speak, the longer I take, because you have to condense, be very specific. You can't beat around the bush. 1 to 2 hour conversation actually takes me 6 to 8 hours to prepare. But the shorter ones actually takes me 20 hours. And being a full-time working parent, it's a lot of time. And then, yeah, like you said, it could be the gender. We don't ask for race. I always used to think my work will do the talking, so I don't have to market myself. And culturally, I was told that you should never speak about yourself. You know, that's considered like headstrong, headweight. Others should speak about you. You work on your limitations, but you cannot talk about yourself. It's like blowing your own trumpet. So I got conditioned. Cut to now, if you don't advocate for yourself, nobody will, right? You put your oxygen mask on yourself first. And I'm in my 30s, okay, Philippa, and I'm still working on that. It's not coming naturally, but it's the name of the game. And if you don't catch that game, you will be left behind.
You can actually, though, build on a little bit of what you said about the cultural, because really good PR and really good marketing does get other people talking about you and raising you up and lifting you up and putting you in that spotlight. But if you don't step up to get yourself into their awareness, and the whole thing to me, the definition of what is marketing, marketing is getting people to care. And when you get people to care, so sometimes we also need to be aware of who are those third parties through media, through partnerships, through conferences, events, who are the ones creating that platform and allowing that spotlight, getting other people to positively talk about us. So you can use that part of the cultural conditioning, but you're absolutely right. You have to break out and speak up and speak out for those people to even know about you. Because if I've learned anything from marketing and media, it's its own resume. When you want to speak at a conference, they say, what other conferences have you spoke at? When you want to be in a magazine, what other magazines have you been in? You build a media resume. And the more that you've done, the more that you can point to, the more opportunities at larger scales open up.
Exactly. And till last year, I used to think to speak at conferences, you have to be the best of, is as though you're the either the founder or the co-author of all these tools and tech. And people who are mediocres like me, I'm neither bad at something nor great at something, somewhere just in the middle, just surviving. I would think that there is no place for me, and I was so wrong. In the last 1 to 2 years, having spoken at 7-8 tech conferences, I've realized that it's not about how much you know, it's about the art of storytelling. And then the feedback I received was, you made it look so simple. You made it understand, because I would have some nice, cool visuals that I would create, my take. I would weave storytelling, use my tone to kind of build some drama, have some pop quizzes, have some history, play of words, alliterations. You know, sometimes it just feels like you're in a drama class, you're doing some dramatics. And in fact, people love it. I'm like, oh, you can be mediocre and kind of personalize with your own skills. It's almost like you're talking impromptu, but doing improv, right? And not everyone can do that. Then I started embracing my superpower. And trust me, the day I embraced myself, I started getting all these things. It's like almost the nature and power of manifestation happening. That means earlier I was my own enemy, thinking that I'm mediocre. I don't deserve these things because I'm not good at it too. Now, using the same things, it's like having that digital photo frame, you're painting different picture every day. And you know, each one gets to see a different thing because you're presenting your perspective. It's the same concept, right? Case in point, I was talking to someone, they said, oh, I don't understand what Kubernetes is. If you know, Kubernetes is the containerization platform. And there was some confusion. They said, oh, this is Docker, this is Kubernetes. I said, think of it as a Tetris game. You know, in Tetris, you know, you just keep having these things. If one thing dies, the other thing tries to fit in. And they said, think of it like a dishwasher mechanism, how you try to fit in your dishes all the time. It's like a Tetris. You keep adjusting so they all fit, and the spindle can actually water all of them and equally wash them. So it's a game of Tetris even in your dishwasher, because you're constantly adjusting and organizing, layering them nicely so that everyone receives that water and then gets washed. They're like, okay, wow. Then I'm like, oh, okay. So I realized something which others didn't, and it's kind of cool. And then it kind of started getting me going without me putting myself, because people started appreciating, and I'm like, okay, this is a good skill to have, you know.
Absolutely. The storytelling is kind of where I started. I worked in the entertainment media field for my first part of my career. When I went to USC, I went there because of their entertainment and media program. Although I learned very early on, I decided I was going to be a minor in film and a major. I started with English. And then I loved critical analysis, and I loved to read, I loved to write. But when we got to the class on short stories, I would write things that were more my day, blogging before there was blogging. And they're like, that's not a short story. And I saw how talented the people around me were. And I think there's a difference between struggling to learn something that is learnable and you'll get there versus things that are really so far out of, you're just like, this is not where I belong. And so I decided at that point, I just discovered that there was a major called International Relations, which I'd never even heard of before. And it actually came even for someone who was studying political science. And I was like, well, I'm not as interested in domestic politics as I am in, you know, I'm interested in culture and the world, and the global piece of it seemed very interesting to me. So I switched majors because I felt like I could get all the reading and writing that I was quite good at and very comfortable with. And yet I was learning about history and culture and the world, and that was a good fit for me. And then now with my graduate studies, layering in urban planning and GIS and spatial data science, and now I'm adding that to human security and geospatial intelligence. So I'm sort of building and layering. But my minor was in film. I worked in the entertainment industry. And so my foundations are in storytelling. And I feel that learning spatial data science is another tool in my toolkit to tell stories, but that now are informed by data and now are informed by maps and how we can tell stories with visual design on maps.
Interesting, right? How it's all intertwined and interconnected. You know, it's like filmmaking. There's a storyteller who has to tell great story. There's the director who has to visualize the story. And also these actors who have to personalize their stories, bring in emotions that perhaps they don't relate to, but then start bringing in that. And then there is the art director who has to. So it's such a teamwork. It's not like one is superior or another. I mean, the director and the writer has to get equal credit. So even our software project is all about having all these people, you know, the success is not just the success of the manager or the director. Of course, they see the vision. They kind of set this vision and mission for the company, for the team, for the culture. But then the execution also lies in the effectiveness of good engineers. And also the success also depends on, have they been treated well? Have they been treated with kindness? Have they been heard? You know, there are good days and bad days, happy days and sad days everywhere. And then how they all come together, it's like a happy marriage of sorts. And throw in storytelling, you know, if you can't articulate, you have this greatest software in the world, but if you cannot explain to your clients what it is in a very basic fashion, most of the clients are not even tech savvy. They approve the project, they're paying the money, but if you complicate things for them, they get disappointed because they said, all I wanted was a simple button. Why did you add so much jazz? You know, because you need to know your audience. You need to know that they may not even know all these cool software terms or lingo that you talk about, right? So it's also about understanding your audience and how can you keep it simple?
I have a tool that I like to share about how to, a lot of people who aren't as knowledgeable about, where do I start? How do I tell a story? You start with a triangle, and on there's three threads of the triangle. On one is you, the other is your audience, and the third is your mission. And your audience cares about the side of you that relates to who the audience is and what is the mission. So you start by kind of writing down notes on what's everything I know about this audience. Who are they? Where do they come from? And we talk about marketing. That's the whole point of storytelling, especially in marketing, is getting people to care. And so you then sort of go, well, what's my mission with this audience? Is it educate them, inform them? What's my call to action? What am I trying to get this? How do I get them to care? What do I want them to care about? What do I want them to do? And then you bring it back to you. Okay, what aspects of myself do I need to introduce to give myself credibility that relates to this audience and this mission? And in the middle of that is your story.
It's interesting how you have been mentioning about marketing with how people care. I always used to think in general, marketing is about leads to sales, leads to revenue, because marketing and sale, all they need to do is advertise to the extent that people eventually buy the product through subscription model or a one-off. I never realized the fundamental concept of marketing and sales is actually to have people. And once they care, they buy it anyway. I never thought about it, and thank you for that perspective. I think I would look at it as with this goal where you let people care. The moment you care, you just give it all, right?
Mm-hmm. You're invested. And I think a lot of the, and this goes back to my work in entertainment, we got pitched a lot of stories, fictional stories, nonfiction, and our whole evaluation, because we were in that middle management, agency manager, so we were kind of the gatekeepers in a way, but we were going to be selling to someone else. And our question, and it was a compliment to say, to ask the question, who cares? So if you tell me something, you want to tell me a story, you want to say, hey, I want to write a book, or I want to do a speech. If I were to say, who cares? I don't mean that in any disrespect. I want you to passionately come back and say, here's who cares and why.
Know your audience in a way.
And if you know, so when you're thinking about speaking at a conference, to ask the question, who cares? And when you can answer that question, who cares? Well, here's why they care, because it's relevant, it's timely. They're perhaps on the back foot in their jobs because things are changing around them and they want to learn to keep up. Whatever it is, whatever their motivation is, their fear, their desire, and that you're tapping into all of those emotions and bringing them along with you and helping them to have a transformation, to fill a gap. That's the...
Yeah, it's all the as though you found a purpose by knowing your audience. And the moment you know who you're catering to, it feels like you can just break down those silos and then just connect to them. If you just come up with very high-fi, over-the-top things that... And perhaps your audience are school-going children, right? It's if you know your purpose and mission and who you're catering to, I think half the job is done in a way.
Yeah, because the word and the phrase who cares is obviously oftentimes used in a dismissive, diminutive way. Like, who cares? Like, it's not important. But if you can ask that question and answer it passionately and in detail, you've got something. And that's where we found, you know, the difference between, I mean, actually the rule of Hollywood, don't be boring. It is really, you know, another part of it is don't be boring. And I think even like I got a master's in urban planning, and I think that's the thing is to me, that's kind of boring. So I layered on a gist. I layered on a second master's. Now I'm getting a little bit of like, tell me more. I want to learn these things. Absolutely. I'm in deep detail of wanting to learn SQL and Python and how, and the Esri software and all of these technical pieces, but I'm wanting to get it to a point where my education leads not only to my caring, but I can invite and inspire other people to care as well, because I can put and connect dots that maybe wouldn't be put together if I wasn't intersecting these disciplines.
Exactly. That's why I like the term osmosis. You know, people think osmosis is just related to science and physics, but it's just the power of absorption. And then, you know, I also like the term synergy. One person cannot know it all. Just the sum total of all these individuals, their knowledge, their assimilation actually helps. Like, if I didn't know much, if I had you were hypothetically running a series on a topic and I heard 5-6 experts over these 6 podcasts talking, I still am not an expert, but I get these 6 different perspectives. And then that kind of can shape my knowledge, and that's where the power of osmosis also comes in. And then knowledge is all about assimilation. Knowledge is all about having these thought leaders give their own take, sometimes a perspective different from yours, sometimes a perspective same as yours, but then just agreeing to disagree and also bringing, you know, these talks. Like, case in point, is AI a boon or a bane, or is AI going to replace humans? Is it going to take our job? Just having these thought leaders give these voices, it just opens up so many channels in your head. It's like those synapses are just bursting.
They absolutely. And I think that community ends up being a big part of it, because you get that from being part of conversations and having, like you said, your vibe is your tribe. And those people come to you because we're all sort of figuring these same things out and working together. Is how I'm approaching it is this idea of not so much coming at it saying I'm a big query GIS expert as much as saying I'm a spatial expert. And then here are the platforms and tools that I'm going to be able to speak and utilize and be a proponent of, and that Google would feel comfortable sending me to a conference to talk about. I want to give you my perspective, and is I feel that I need a great amount of technical proficiency, and I'm working really hard to gain that, and I need time. I feel like I've got another 18 months ahead of me in my academic program. And so for me in the GDE process, I feel that there's some learning I need to do, but I'm already now a year and a half into my learning. Someone said it was about 5 years of professional experience that was needed to really kind of own GDE. But when you are GDE, what they do is they pay for all of your travel. They'll pay for you to go be the speaker, be the presenter.
What a privilege, no? Like, I didn't even know about GDE till 3 months back. And, you know, I used to think GDE is only Google Tech, Google, very specific Google products like Flutter. And I'm like, oh, I'm a generalist. I mean, I do my own things. I specialize more so in Microsoft technology. So somewhere I think I was my own enemy. And then if you don't break out of your own barriers, how will people know? And then very, like, you know, the shy girl who nudges to propose or say, hey, I like you, in a very shy manner, coy manner. I just had the final courage to ask them, hey, how do you become a GDE? You know, then I'm like, oh, anyone can, as long as they're passionate technologists and they work, you can back up with your credentials. I'm like, okay. And, you know, it's sometimes, you know, your own shyness, you just write off yourself as, I don't know, compared to all these GDEs, and I've been in the industry for 14 years. It's not just a year or two. I've been a full stack engineer for, I'm going to be 15 soon, 15 years in the tech industry. So I've seen it all, and somewhere I was my own enemy, right? Exactly. I had very similar assumptions. I think that's the right word, where I said, I specialized in Microsoft stack, and is there a conflict of interest? Are they, you know, eventually, I realized I should have just asked first. But then the moment I came into WTM, there's a big overlap. Many WTMs are GDEs, GDSCs. They are also the student clubs. They're also the GDG leads. And then I, you know, you just keep following their profile. And then I realized that, you know, technology is agnostic of many things. It's like if you look at... there's a term called, in databases, I forgot, maybe I'll message you, it's something called polyglot persistence or something, where, you know, today it's SQL, tomorrow you replace with MySQL or something. It's just the schema changes, but the fundamental data changes. Unless you talk about SQL versus NoSQL, those are different, right? Mm-hmm. It's about how do you make databases very agnostic of depending on one tech stack over another or one tool. Or it's, again, it's all a relational database, so to say, right? Mm-hmm. NoSQL today, it's MongoDB, tomorrow it could be something else. But if they're all document based, you shouldn't do so much rewriting that it breaks. You should be able to, it's you know, in software we call it like a factory pattern. You know, today if it is this, tomorrow you replace with another object, it should still work. You know, so I think the whole emphasis of Google to be a technology leader by empowering all these experts from different medium, different platforms, different segment, race, culture, to just come in for the passion of technology, I think speaks volumes about where they are and how that makes all of us, you, me, and all the people we know of, so passionate about, because they just say, we can all coexist. You could have your own stack, I could have my own stack. To the world in terms of finances and budgeting, we are competitors, but fundamentally, we are in it for the power and passion of technology. And also, right, when you feel cared and represented, you organically start marketing. They care and invest in you so much. It's like, you know, when you have so many choices, let's say you have this local community, local mom business you want to support versus this big thing. Who do you support? Who makes you feel cared? You know, so ultimately it all comes down to when someone invests in you, shows that gratitude, you just go places, you know, they don't have to do anything, you know, just that small lift that they give you and then just that opening the floodgates, it will automatically make you embrace. And then I remember this year I recommended WTM program to at least 10 people. I'm also part of a mentor work group in Vancouver. And unfortunately, 8 of them didn't get through, only one of them got through. Then I realized it's the competition. They received so many more applications. I heard they received a whopping amount compared to last year. Maybe that's how I got lucky last year, I guess. Because we started making that awareness, now they can only select, let's say, 100 per cohort or something, right? But there are like some, it's all because it started giving us so much that we are spreading the awareness. But then there's only so much they can accommodate. It's not like you just bring everybody and dilute it, right? And when I'm representing myself, I'm not just representing myself. I'm representing my organization, my culture, my community, my tribe, you know, so many things. So somewhere you have to start being mindful and ensure that you're not being a people pleaser by trying to please everybody, but then being mindful of representing a good image of everyone you represent, right? Exactly. It's not about, like, I feel nowadays every market is getting cluttered. Podcasting market, YouTube market, TikTok, the influencers, you know, Instagram, everything is getting cluttered. But I realize there's a space for everyone. You know, I always like to give this anecdote where there was television, and then when theaters came, people were like, oh, do we lose it? It existed. And then the streaming platforms came. You have Amazon Prime, Netflix, Hulu, and so many things. People said, oh, do we have to close theaters now? Because it's going to be out of, people are not going to theaters, you know. But they still try to coexist. That's where a healthy competition comes in. You have things for streaming platform, you have things for a 3D entertainment, you have things where your whole family can go. We can all coexist. Of course, the competition is going to be high. It's the same thing. You know, there are thousands of podcasts, thousands of other mediums where people walk and represent and what. But then when I give my voice to someone who has a great code of conduct, has these documents where I can go through, see how are they monetizing it, are they also doing a charitable cause? Because sometimes it's also important who you're lending your cause to, right? There's time is the only thing that's finite. I wish it was infinite, no, unfortunately. But then you should also be very cognizant of who are you representing? What are their value systems like? You know, if on a very basic level, you can't do everything for money, right? If you just don't like, you don't believe in their value system or where they're coming from somewhere, I think you should question yourself, why are you doing something, right? It's very important. That's why whenever people approach, I like to do my own little research and just be mindful of who I am, because if I have to bear it all and just be open about it, that means I'm appreciating the value somewhere. If I'm giving you this voice and acknowledging, that means that I'm valuing you and I'm acknowledging that, you know, I believe in you, I trust in you for you to take me to the next level. So it's very important to go beyond money. That's where in the WTM meeting last week, I said one for the kitchen, one for the soul. So there are always things, sometimes you just do it for money. That doesn't mean I'm not happy. I'm happy, but sometimes passion doesn't always bring you money, but sometimes you want to do things just for the community, for the greater good. I think that's where I'm at, and sometimes they can all coexist, right?